Well, just a few houses up in our neighborhood, when I was a kid, lived a family with two sons, and the oldest son was about my brother's age, maybe a year younger. At the time, he was about 8, and he had a brother. His younger brother, David, was about 4. And one summer afternoon, their mom called our house, and she asked if David was playing at our house, which almost never happened. David rarely left his own backyard. So in talking to my mom, David's mother began to grow frantic as it dawned on her that she didn't know where David was, and she didn't know where he had been at least for 30 minutes. And so she called other neighbors, and in no time, the concern was heightened up and down our street. People, where's David? Has anyone seen David? So caring neighbors were showing up at their house, asking how they could help. A friend of mine, he and I hopped on our bikes and we rode through the neighborhood looking for him. And the mom ended up calling the police. So we had a couple of patrol cars show up and they were asking questions. No one had seen David. And if you've ever experienced anything like this, you know, the longer that goes on, the more worried people become. Now, behind our neighborhood, there was a new addition being built and someone mentioned a retention pond. And like, we ought to check that out. Well, that just sent his mother into hysteria. And so another 40 minutes went by with no sign of David, and our concerns had reached their peak. And you know what happens? Fear plays with your imagination, and you begin to think of all, just the absolute worst things have happened. And so it just fuels people searching more and more. And so my friend and I, we make another trip. Maybe we missed him. We loop around the neighborhood again. So we're returning to my house because we hadn't seen him. We return to my house and I see my mom and a crowd of people walking away from their house. And some are just shaking their heads. Some are snickering. Some have big grins on their faces. And we see the patrol car leaving. So I asked my mom, what's going on? And she said that David's mom found him. Apparently he crawled under their master bed and took a nap. Now, when something goes missing, at least in the moment, what is lost becomes infinitely more important than what's not lost. If you can't find your engagement ring, you're not comforted by the fact that you still have a diamond necklace and some diamond earrings. Say you lose your credit card. You don't care that you still have your other credit card and your debit card. Finding that lost credit card means everything. We don't have to worry about what finding the one that's not lost. We're worried about what we're missing, what is lost. And that's how Luke 15 opens up God's heart for everybody, to show us how our Heavenly Father views people. And I was putting this series together shortly after the first of the year, and there's a young minister in North Carolina who I've mentored some for the last 3 years, and we've been talking about our preaching calendar for the year, and so he was asking me about what I was doing. I said, well, I got this series I want to do in February on showing mercy, what that means, what that looks like as a church, how do we show mercy to others around us. And so I was talking with him. He said, you know, I heard a message. I think you ought to look at it. It's by Andy Stanley. And so I checked it out, and I got to tell you, I fell into a God moment just watching that. My heart was so moved by that message, and it gripped my heart. And so a lot of what I'm sharing with you today comes out of that experience of listening to that message and weeping over the way the Lord was challenging me. So as we look at that today, I want you to remember that when something goes missing, what is lost is so much more urgent than what's not lost. And so we come to Luke 15, and it's all about the labels and the labelers. The labels and the labelers. It says in verse 1, now the tax collectors and sinners, there you have the labels right there. Tax collectors and sinners, we're all drawing near to him, to hear him. Verse 2, here come the labelers. And the Pharisees and the scribes grumbled, saying, this man receives sinners and eats with them. And one of the most baffling things about Jesus is he's undoubtedly a religious leader. Everyone thought of Jesus as a religious teacher, himself being likened to a rabbi. The thing is that Jesus didn't spend a whole lot of time with the religious people, at least not intentionally. Now, they showed up and created all kinds of issues in around Jesus' life. But if you look at Jesus, you find him exactly where Luke 15 shows him, in the company of irreligious people, people who were nothing like him. And the thing is that the people that were almost nothing like Jesus liked Jesus. And Jesus liked them. And so Luke uses the language of the day to describe that in Luke 15 and verse 1. So he uses these two labels, tax collectors and sinners. Now, tax collectors, we have our own opinions of the IRS, and most of them are probably accurate. I mean, take it as far as you want to. It probably is accurate, right? You know. But tax collectors were among those ostracized because their work was considered to be immoral. What they would do is not just collect taxes, but they would collect their own tribute, basically. So they're like, you know, legal mobsters who get their cut after enforcing Roman law on taxes. And so when it came to the Jewish people in the temple, those were thought to be like some of the worst of the worst. I mean, you rank a tax collector up with a prostitute. You rank a tax collector up with a murderer. A tax collector is a thief. But now you get another word, another label, sinners. Sinners. Now we think of sinners and we think, yes, sinners do this and sinners do that. And sinners are, you know, a sinner because they do what? Yeah, pretty basic, isn't it? A sinner sins. But that's not how the Jewish people, at least the religious Jewish people, thought about sinners. They didn't necessarily identify sinners by their behavior. They identified sinners as pretty much any outsider. Any person who really had nothing to do with temple and temple life. They didn't have anything to do with religion. And so it's a common expression for those among the religious people to the people that just don't belong, the people that don't fit in. And again, it wasn't necessarily because of their behavior. For example, shepherds are an example. Shepherds were considered sinners. And it wasn't because, you know, they were necessarily dishonest or because they had, just as a group of guys, they had all kinds of defects spiritually. It wasn't that at all. It's just that their profession caused them to be around animals all the time. That brought with it some ideas about being ceremonially unclean. A shepherd's on call all the time, so a shepherd hardly has time for temple activities. And so you don't go to temple. You're not considered to be religious. You're considered to be a sinner. You just don't fit in. You're an outsider. So just anyone considered an outsider was basically a person the religious crowd looked at and said, they just don't fit. They don't fit. They don't care about religious things. They don't love the law like we do. They don't come to the temple. They don't offer their sacrifices. They're kind of like outsiders. They don't fit. And so in the Gospels, one of the reasons that people like that, the people that were not like Jesus, one reason they went around Jesus is because he's a religious guy, but he dropped a lot of the labels. Jesus almost never addressed anyone as, hey, tax collector, hey, prostitute, hey, sinner, hey, immoral person. He didn't use that kind of language. It was so different because Jesus is a religious guy. And this created friction between Jesus and the religious leaders because I thought, wait a minute, he's a rabbi, he's from God. In fact, you have Nicodemus, who is one of the most respected of the leaders. And Nicodemus comes to Jesus in John 3 and verse 2, and he says, Rabbi, we know you're a teacher. You've come from God. Nobody can do what you do. No one can teach like you do unless you've come from God. But you know what they were seeing Jesus do? Hang out with the people that the religious people didn't like. And you know what the religious people thought about the people that they didn't like? God must not like them either. Because we're doing all the things that are right to go to the temple and keep the law, and God should be pleased with us. In fact, we're pretty sure God's okay with us. God probably likes us better. But the outsiders, God doesn't like them. Look how they live. They don't care about his temple. They don't care about his law. And so because Jesus spent so much time with the religious outsiders, it created friction, and they They were saying, why does Jesus spend so much time with them? And so Luke says, yeah, this was one of those days. All these irreligious people were coming to Jesus. And so Jesus knows this. He knows what the religious crowd thinks, and he knows even what the tax collectors and sinners are thinking, because they're thinking, listen, the religious crowd doesn't like us. We don't really care to be with them. But somehow in Jesus, they come together. And so Jesus views people differently. He views people differently than the super religious crowd, and he viewed people differently than the way the outsiders thought that God viewed them. So this is how it's setting up. And so Jesus begins to teach both groups at the same time with three short parables. And they're full of exaggeration and hyperbole and a lot of comedy. There's a lot of humor here. If you get into it enough, you'll see it. But Jesus really wraps in the religious people that are there, trying to hear what he has to say, and also the irreligious people, the temple people and the outsider people, the tax collectors and sinners, and the Pharisees, the righteous, the religious. And he begins to wrap them into this truth about how God sees people. So if you look at verse 3, he begins this way, the parable of the lost sheep. And listen, when Jesus starts in on this, every man present has an attachment. They know what Jesus is talking about. And so verse 3, he told them this parable. Verse 4, what man of you, having 100 sheep, if he lost one, does not leave the 99 in the open country and after that one is lost until he finds it? And everyone in the crowd is nodding their head. Yeah, we get that. We know that. Even one of 100 is valuable. That one of 100 means livelihood for us. It means food on the table for our family. That one sheep has tremendous value. It doesn't matter that we got 99 left. We're missing one, and that one means a lot. Remember what we said? When something goes missing, at least in the moment, what's lost is infinitely more urgent than what's not lost. So a shepherd, knowing that there's one lost, even his reputation is at stake. Imagine he's the shepherd, and he lost one. Guess what goes on his resume, right? I don't know if you want him looking after your sheep. He's lost a few in his life. He doesn't want that reputation, so he loses one. What does he do? He goes to get it. Everyone's nodding their head in approval. Yeah, we get that. That's what shepherds should do. Now the next part, there's a little humor. Verse 5, and when he found it, he lays it on his shoulders and he's rejoicing. Now that makes sense. Sure, he's rejoicing. He's got this beast on his shoulders, but this beast means income and blessing, and it means increase, and it means good reputation. He's found it. He's carrying it back to the flock. Now verse 6, he goes a little overboard. Jesus says, and when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors and says, rejoice with me. I have found my sheep that was lost. Now I got to tell you, and the people in the crowd would have said, really? That seems a little... We get what you're saying, Jesus. He's important to the shepherd. If the shepherd loses one, he would definitely go and risk his own safety to go find this one lost sheep. It means a lot. It's a very valuable thing. Your reputation's at stake. Sure, you bring it home, but rejoicing, ha ha, that's kind of funny, but it makes sense. You care that much about this, so you might, at least inside, you're rejoicing. I don't know if you throw a party. I mean, what do you do? Find one lost sheep, you kill another and celebrate? I mean, probably not. Probably not. But you got to imagine who's in the crowd. You got irreligious people others, the religious crowd said, you're an outsider, you don't belong to us. And then you got the religious people that are thinking, wait a minute, what are we hearing here? Jesus is saying something about sinners. Look what Jesus says, verse 7. So I tell you, there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents for the 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. And imagine kind of in the stifled laughter in the crowd at Jesus' story, you're an outsider and you're thinking, wait a minute, you're saying God rejoices over me? You mean God is interested in someone like me? I'm not one of the righteous. I don't go to the temple. I don't have anything to do with the temple. I don't have anything to do with the religious crowd. They don't have anything to do with me. What are you saying God's interested in me? You mean he's like a shepherd who would leave the people that seem to have their own religious houses in order? I mean, I've seen these religious people and they like have good lives and they're moral people and they don't have to go through the wreckage that I've gone through, some of the decisions I've made, the ways that they don't have to live with that. God must love them. How could he love me? And Jesus is saying, listen, when a sinner comes and repents, God is more excited over that than all the righteous people that never left. Really? Really? Is that how God feels about me? And then the religious leaders in the crowd are thinking, wait a minute. You mean God is more interested in those people? God cares. These are people I won't even let into my house. And God cares about those people? And Jesus would probably say, yeah. Yeah. Let me tell you another story just to make myself clear. So he goes to another parable, verse 8. He says, or what woman? He moves from the shepherd. He talks about a particular woman. And this would have been a very good way of illustrating the truth. Because in the crowd, how many know this? That men and women hear things on different levels and respond in different ways. And so, you know, if you ever sit in like a church with your spouse or someone and you're getting it and you're nodding, but then, you know, your spouse, your wife, men, I'm talking to men here, you're hearing something that goes right over your head, but your wife is stilettoing you in the ribs because you're not getting this and you need to get this. So Jesus knows the dynamic of the people. And so he uses an illustration about a woman. He says, verse 8, what woman having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she finds it? Now, this is a parable. It's linked to the other. Jesus is just illustrating the truth again. And he uses the story of a woman who's lost one of 10 coins. Now, the word here has to do with a currency. In that day, it was a drachma, and it could have been a very valuable thing. It may not have been all that valuable to other people. But there's a couple ways to understand this. The first is the woman's age. We don't know what age she was. We don't know how Jesus is referring to her, but there's a couple possibilities. Number one is she could have been a young woman. And a young woman and her having 10 coins could have had something to do with like a family dowry for her. And so in that culture, one way that a girl's family would say she's available is they would grant her a dowry. And it sounds kind of odd, but it's a way of saying, listen, she's available. You know, if you want her, you get the dowry. And this would have been, again, 10 coins. There was even a headdress. And so, I don't know, it's like, you know, speed dating. You wear it out and you got your coins on. And yeah, well, I like her. And she's got all 10 coins. So let's see if she'll go out on a second date. Or she could have been the other possibility. Again, we don't know her age. She could have been a widow. And in that culture, a widow has very, very little to fall back on in terms of financial means. If she's lost her husband and she doesn't have family to take care of her and she's very poor, in all likelihood, widows were usually very poor, limited financial means. And so what does she have in her life? 10 silver coins. If she loses one, she's lost a lot, hasn't she? Yeah, she has. And so Jesus, as this woman begins to sweep and to look and to light a lamp and to look and find, she's hoping that the light of her lamp will catch the metallic surface of that coin. Or as she's sweeping, she's hoping she'll hear the clinking of that coin because she knows she can't go on until she finds it. She can't do another thing in life. It's so important to her because what's lost is much more urgent than what's not lost. She has to find it. She has to find it. In verse 9, Jesus says, and when she finds it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me. I found the coin that I lost. Now, does that really happen? Probably not. What is Jesus illustrating? He's kind of going overboard, exaggerating it, going into some humor to say, all right, who really does this? A woman that desperate does that. A woman that joyful over what she's found, she does that. Verse 10, so I tell you, there is joy before the angels of God over one sinner who repents. A woman who loses something that valuable, who will spare no energy, no time. She gives everything she can to find that which is so precious to her. And Jesus says that's how heaven is about lost people. That says that's how heaven is about the outsiders. And again, the outsiders are thinking, really? God's that interested in me? And the religious crowd is thinking, really? God is that interested with people that I'm not that interested in? So Jesus says, well, yeah. So let me tell you another story. In verse 11, he says, there was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me a share of the property that is coming to me. And he divided his property between them. And so the whole audience is listening to Jesus, and he takes them deeper. He says, all right, let's talk about family. Let's talk about family. And again, it's got some comedy and some heartbreak and some emotion. And so the son essentially comes to his father and says, Dad, I want what's going to be mine when you die. In fact, I want it now. I want it now. Give it to me now. You know what translation is? I'm really not interested anymore in being your son. You might as well be dead. All right? So what you were going to give me on the day that you die, I'll take it right now. Now imagine what everyone in the crowd is thinking. That ingrate. You know, can you believe that? Is this a real Jesus? Is this a real story? Because that sounds pretty. I think I've heard this story before. Jesus, where did you hear this? Is an ungrateful son. This son ought to be beaten. Surely the father's going to lessen his son's inheritance, maybe kick him out of the house. Think of it. A generation or more has gone into this wealth. This could have been family wealth. This could have been passed down for generations. And it only grew and grew and grew. And this son, this ingrate, this guy who feels like he's entitled to everything and he thinks he deserves it and he's earned it and he's no longer interested in actually working for it. He just goes to his dad and says, Dad, yeah, now. Give it to me now. I want it now. And I don't want any more relationship with you. In fact, that's the way it's got to work. I'm going to take it and leave. And you can imagine how incensed the crowd is. This is a wicked son. What son would treat his father that way? And the point is that the son, listen, that son is long gone relationally, isn't he? He's not interested in a relationship, but that went away a long time ago. Before he ever left, he's physically there, but there's no love, there's no attention, there's no affection. Father, give it to me now, I'm out of here. And what does the father do? This has got to create some static with the crowd too. The father does something that no one in Jesus' audience saw coming. They're saying, kick him out. Cut him off. Cut him loose. But the father wants to reconnect with the son so bad that he chooses to do the most convenient thing. And I got to tell you, I used to never understand this with parents and their prodigals. I used to think, yeah, okay, let's pray. Let's give them up to God. Say, God, you deal with them. I can't deal with them anymore. God, you do. And you know, I get parents to say, what? No. No, no, let's don't go that far. I mean, we're really sorrowful that their hearts are breaking the heart of God and they broke our hearts and they're living and choosing lifestyles that we never raised them to do. And this is hurting us, but we don't like want real judgment on them. We don't want them hurting. Isn't that a parent's heart? They break the heart of God, but they're not willing for judgment. They don't want that. Every parent of a prodigal knows this. You want to restore relationship. So what does the father do? He writes the check. He says, son, it's yours. He divides the inheritance, gives it to the son, and the son leaves. It didn't affect the son staying. The son didn't turn around and say, God, Father, I really didn't realize you love me this much. You know what? I think I'll stay. He didn't do that, did he? He bolted. He's out the door. So he gives him inheritance. And everyone's thinking, what a fool this father is. Who does that? However, the father, again, valuing his relationship with his son, he values his relationship with his son more than his own reputation. I don't care what people think about me. This is our business and I'm making my choice here. I don't want to lose my son. So the crowd's incensed at this point. They're incredulous over the son's selfishness. They're shocked by how the father responded. So it goes deeper. Look at verse 13. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had. He took a journey into a far country and he squandered his property in reckless living. You know what the crowd is saying? Yeah. He deserves that. Let's see how much worse it can get. And it does get worse. In verse 14, when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country and he began to be in need. Yep. He deserves that. He's liquidated generations of wealth. He took what his father would get. He squandered it. He's lived foolishly. Serves a little brat right. And for Jesus' audience, what happened next only confounds the absurdity. Look at verse 15. So what does the son do? He went, this ingrate, this ungrateful kid, this entitled kid, this kid that thinks the world owes him everything. He went and he hires himself out to the citizens of the country and they send him into his field to feed the pigs. There's nothing more insulting in the Jewish culture to have a job like that. Nothing more insulting. And so there are people in the crowd. Yeah, that's right. That's what people deserve who live that way. Verse 16 says, and when he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. So this kid, he's at rock bottom. Below rock bottom, it couldn't get any worse in their eyes. Jesus had, in the story, taken this son down to the place where all the people that said he deserves that, the son gets it. If they were to craft the story and give that son what he deserved, boy, he got it. Until verse 17. Ungrateful little punk came to himself and he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? And I perish here with hunger. I'll arise, go to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. He's wasted everything. He comes to feel what he really lost. And it was more than money, wasn't it? He realized something about his father's character, something he had given up. He misses his family. And you know what else he's wondering? I know he's thinking this because there are thousands of people all over Alamance County that think this today. I miss home, but does anyone at home miss me? And if you're an irreligious person and you've been in a crowd full of religious people that say you're an outsider, you don't belong, you know what you think? I miss home, but I don't think anyone's missing me. I miss what I learned about God as a child, but God's probably not missing me. I can't go back as a son. Maybe my father will take me back as a servant. And in Jesus' audience are people just like us. And there are other people in the crowd who might be like nothing like us. And you know what they're thinking? I'm nothing at all like people that don't have their acts together. I'm nothing at all like people who really do well at being good. I know I'm disconnected from God and I miss that, but is that missing me? Can my life make any connection in life? Can I make any kind of connection with God? I would if I could, but I don't know if they're missing me enough to let me back. Now, other people are stunned. Jesus goes on, he says, verse 20, he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced and kissed him. Son takes a chance. I'm going to go home. I'll go home asking my father if I can simply be a servant. But here's where the story turns, and what happened blew the minds of the audience. And the reason it did is because Jesus drops the labels that they use, and he talks about the labels that the father uses. The Father saw him and he felt. You got to know this. Everything you see and everything you feel is based on the labels you create. You set a value in your own mind before you ever go shopping for what you're looking for, don't you? Yeah, too much. I'm not paying that price for those jeans. They don't even fit me well. Or they're not the brand I want. So we've already created the label. This is acceptable. This is not acceptable. This is worthy of my money. This is not worthy of my money. The Father sees the Son and he's already assigned a label because he already knows the value. And when he saw his Son come back on the road, what would you feel? Imagine the crowd. What do they feel? The Son comes back, the ungrateful little kid, the snotty-nosed kid who thought he could do better with his father's wealth, and he comes back empty-handed, and he's broken, and he says, Father, let me be a servant. You know what some in the crowd would say? No, you don't belong here anymore. Wouldn't that be what they would say? No, you need a few more years living like that before we let you back in here. You need to do your time. This is not the way it works here. You want to be welcomed here? You got to work for it. You got to show us that you can endure this a little bit longer. Maybe we'll let you in then. And the Father saw him, and what did he feel? The word's compassion, but you know what another word would be? Mercy. He felt mercy. He felt compassion. Jesus' audience must have grasped when he finished the sentence. And the Father saw him and he felt compassion. You know, if the Father shared their labels, the story doesn't turn out the way it does it? Verse 20, while he was still a long way off, his Father saw him and felt, you know what, I think about this story, I'm thinking, okay, the Father the whole time has been waiting for this. His eyes have been waiting for the silhouette of his Son to break the horizon of that road and come walking back home. And he goes and he runs and embraces him. If you were that kid's father, aren't you thinking, couldn't I have done this a few weeks ago or however long it was when he left? I mean, I would have gone then, right? And people in the crowd are maybe even thinking that, why not try to convince him to stay in the first place? Why let the Son go? And I think there's a reason for it. When the Son left, he desired no relationship with the Father. When the Son left, he was not interested in being the Father's Son. When the Son left, he was not interested in having a father. So you can imagine that father day after day after day after day after day. Whatever he's doing that day, he's always walking by the road that leads to that event. Will my son come home? And you know, you can probably imagine this in a small town, and someone says, hey, I saw your son the other day. What happened to him? I saw your son the other day. What's going on? I saw your son the other day. What did something happen between the two of them? Boy, I saw your son and I didn't like what he was doing. I saw him in a place I didn't think he would ever be. You know what the Father's been doing day after day after day after day, listening to that, but always looking. Could he come home today? Is this today? And the Son comes back in verse 22. He's broken. And the Father and the Son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. You know, he doesn't say, Dad, boy, that was a mistake. I don't know what I was thinking. But I'm like back now. So that's not his attitude, is it? He's broken. He said, Father, I'm not worthy to be your son. What I did was willful. It was intentional. It was calculated. It was foolish, but it was calculated. It was stupid, but I did it. I'm not proud of it. It broke me. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And the Father says, Well, let's bring the fatted calf and let's throw a party. Let's do what needs to be done. Let's eat and celebrate. Here's the labels now. Here's the labels that the father uses. My son was dead, now he's alive. My son is lost. My son was lost and now he's found. Look at the labels. Lost and found. Dead and alive. You know what? Those aren't literal words, are they? They're words of relationship. My son was lost to me, now he's found to me. My son was dead to me, now he's alive to me. This son didn't want to be in this house, now this son wouldn't be any other place than this house. This son squandered his life, he wasted his resources, he ran away, he chose his own path, and he failed. And he's broken, and he's wrecked. But he shows back up and he says, Father, if you'll let me back in, I would love to come back in this house. I don't even have to be a son if you'll let me in. I'm willing to be an outsider on the outskirts, but I've got to be here. And the father says, not good enough. My son was dead, now he's alive. My son was lost, now he's found. Let's celebrate. And this is Jesus saying, let me tell you how my father and I view the world. There are disconnected people and connected people. But you know what my priority is? The disconnected. I care about the lost and the dead. And the reason Jesus spent so much time with disconnected people is because they were disconnected. The reason that Jesus spent so much time with lost people, Luke 19 verse 10, the Son of Man came to do what? He came to show up in church and high-five all the saints and say, welcome, buddy. Let's talk about what we do and how we do it well. And let's rejoice over everyone that's here. Let's just get excited and let's do our thing. And people don't have to understand what goes on here, but we know what's going on. We got the handshakes and the high-fives, and we know all the choruses. We know all the lingo. The Son of Man came for that, right? No. He came to seek and save the lost. He came to seek and save the lost. And because we're Jesus' body, you know what? What was true of Jesus better be true of us. We can't forget that the eyes of our Father are on the road. And He's ready to show mercy to the disconnected, to the ones who think they can't possibly have a relationship with the Father. That's what the Father's about. And this is how my Savior and your Savior sees everyone in Elon and Burlington and Gibsonville, McLeansville, every single person in your life. The Father cares about two things. Are they connected to me or are they disconnected from me? Are they lost or are they found? I remember as a kid, in elementary school, every year around Valentine's Day, we would take little bags like this, white bags, brown bags, and we would, back when you were a kid and coloring was like a science. I mean, it was like something you were learning to stay between the lines and just create Michelangelo type coloring stuff. You were really about coloring. And so teachers would give us the bags in advance of Valentine's Day. And we would make these Valentine's bags and sit them on our desk. Now watch that not sit there. Sit there. And but I remember also, like, when you turned 9 or 10, you began to notice a difference in classmates. Really. I mean, there were those who grew up in my neighborhood. Our neighborhood was Northside, and we swam at Northside Pool in the summer, and we played in the same creek with the rope swing, and we played sports in the backyard. We rode our bikes together. We were the Northside kids, and we hung out as Northside kids. But when we got to school, you know, you had the other kids from the other neighborhoods, from Hillside. We had the Walser Drive kids, the West Center Street Extension kids, Spruce Street kids, Erlanger, the mill at Erlanger, Arrington Heights. And we hung out at school. We took spelling tests together. We did PE. We waited all year for field day to come because we love field day. Now, Northside was kind of like middle class. I mean, not everybody was like high middle class. There's all kinds of there in the spectrum, but you know, most people there, you kind of like the same things, lives in the same kind of houses. But there's something about when you get into fourth or fifth grade, you begin to notice how different people are. And you notice that some of the kids from other neighborhoods didn't wear the brands that you wore. Like for us, it was Levi's and Converse, and your parents bought your clothes at the department store downtown. And we noticed what people wore, and we noticed what people were like a little bit more. And so you know what we came up with? Labels. We had labels. Yeah. And so when we talked about like the Hillside kids, we know they're kind of like the Northside kids. They've got their own swimming pool they go to in the summer and they do their thing. In fact, we would play the Northside football team against the Hillside football team. We'd meet at the schoolyard and kick each other's brains out. But at the end of the day, they were like us. But some of the other kids from the other neighborhoods, you thought, boy, they're not like us. A country club's across town, but they go to a different school, so we're not concerned about them. But we noticed these other kids. The funny thing is the labels that we were assigning to them, you know what other people were doing to us? Assigning labels to us. But every day, every year, Valentine's Day would come, and the teacher would say, all right, make your bags, here's the class list, and so when you come to school for Valentine's Day, bring a Valentine, and you got to bring a Valentine for everybody. And so, you know, you show up with your Valentines and you made your mom go get the last box of the Snoopy Valentines or the, you know, whatever the brand was. And now you might have looked through the cards and thought, yeah, I want her to get this one because, like, this is special. I'm looking at that one. Yeah, that says kind of what a fifth grader wants to say to a girl. So she gets that one. But I'm going to give everybody one. And so you show up and you start, yep, it's Valentine's Day. Everybody gets a Valentine. And you got your own on your desk, and so people are coming around to your desk, putting your Valentine in there. Why? Because everybody deserves a Valentine. Everybody gets a Valentine today. And so your bag through the day was filling up with Valentines, and at the end of the day, everybody had the same number of Valentines. And about 30 minutes before school let out, you'd get to open your bag and look at your Valentines, and you thought, you know what? I'm somebody's Valentine. I'm a Valentine to a lot of people today. Everybody got a Valentine, and everybody ought to get mercy. Everybody needs mercy, regardless of the label. Be like the Father. You want to be connected to the Father? I want you to be connected to the Father. Let's bow our heads. Yeah. This love like I've never